Okay, so today is the day the project proposals are due. If you have them, good. If you don't have them, I'm not grading the proposals, so, you know, it's not to worry about it being late in that way. But it's important that if you haven't got a proposal, what's important about your proposal is that you know what you're going to do for your project. Okay? I will look at them, but it's not as important that I know what you're going to do for your project as you know what you're going to do for your project. And it'd be bad for you to find out that you don't know what you're going to do for your project, you know, a couple days before they're actually due. So check to make sure that you have a path in mind of what you will do that will produce a project at the end of the semester. Okay? If you want, I'm very happy to talk with you. Some of you have very interesting projects and ideas for projects, and that's good. Some of you have, I know, have talked to me. Some of you have not talked to me. So long as you have a direction that you think is going to be good, that's fine with me. But make sure you know what you're doing. Okay? Any questions? Okay? And that's especially good. So any project proposal that says, yeah, I'm going to do project number 6, is a bad proposal, probably, because it meant that you just sort of copied down a number and said, yeah, I'm going to do that. You may not have read to the end of the paragraph. You may not have thought it through. Okay? So that's what's important to do before the finals crush the last week of the semester. Any questions? Okay, good. Last class, we started talking about protein folding. My plans for today are we're going to talk a little bit more about protein folding, and then we're going to have a special guest lecture by one of our students, Osim Oker, okay, who actually, you know, kind of folds proteins, so he'll know something about, or plays around with molecular simulations and things like this, so we can get maybe a better perspective as to what these programs actually do. Any questions? Okay. So, last class we talked about protein folding, and the insights that we should have gotten from that is, first of all, protein folding is a hard problem. Okay? It, you know, there's a lot of degrees of freedom. It's, so the standard approach of sort of, you know, trying to do a molecular simulation is a very, very time-consuming thing because every, you know, there's talking about a very high search space. You know, every pair of nucleotides, amino acids, you know, there's an angle to the bond between them, okay? And depending upon the, or every sort of three nucleotides will form some kind of an angle. And, you know, so searching through all possible configurations is impossible. Further, the objective functions to try to figure out what nature is trying to do when folding these proteins are not unambiguous, not sort of all clear, not completely accepted. Okay? So protein folding is an important problem, we agree, because if you could do it, you could predict what proteins do. You know, right now, what would you like to be able to do? You know, you have an organism you've just sequenced. You'd like to run that DNA sequence through a gene prediction program. That will tell you where the proteins are. You'd love to run that protein through a protein folding program. Look at it, maybe figure out what it does, okay, from its shape, where the active sites are, and then help to understand it, okay? So de novo prediction, okay, is very hard, okay, and not incredibly successful, okay? Getting better, but not incredibly successful. I'd like to talk a little bit today about another approach for protein folding that tends to yield better solutions, okay? And it sort of relies on, in some sense, the same crutch that we have relied on for a lot of things this semester, this notion of homology, okay? That, you know, proteins, you know, do not come from a vacuum, you know, in a vacuum, okay? They're the result of genes. Genes are the result of evolution, okay? And so in some sense here, just like we've used homology searching to compare the similarity between, try to recognize genes by noticing that this gene is has a high sequence similarity with another gene. Sort of threading approaches try to make use of, in some sense, homology information. The idea that that proteins with similar function, okay, probably have similar sequences, okay? And in fact, it has been sort of observed that two amino acid sequences with 20 to 30% of identical residues will likely have very similar three-dimensional structures. Okay? Now, 20% identical residues is pretty impressive when you're talking about, there being 20 amino acid residues. Matching 20% of them exactly, it's not like, if you have two DNA sequences and they match in 25% of the bases, that's not very impressive, right? Because two random strings match in 25% of the bases. Okay? But for protein sequences, this much similarity is enough to pretty much guarantee that they have similar 3D structure. So one technique, perhaps the simplest technique to predict structure, would be to go to your database of known structures, okay? And if you have a new protein you want to fold, go to see if it is very, very similar to one of the other ones. And if so, simply report the other folding as your answer. Okay? So that's a homology-based way to do protein folding. Now, in fact, that only would work as if you had a very, very similar protein in the model. But there's something else about homology we might be able to exploit. Okay? It is assumed that protein substructures, basically, there's a small number of useful protein structures in the world. Okay, what I will say is sort of somehow a relatively small number of interesting folds, okay, that has been found in nature. So for example, by an interesting fold, it might be that an important part of a protein might be a pair of these beta sheets, these 14 beta sheets, okay, where two of them are running in parallel and two of them are crossing it. Okay? And this might be an important, this might build a flat structure, this might build something. Okay? The sort of implicit assumption is that there are relatively not small number of sort of useful subfolds, useful shapes that occur in proteins. Okay? And even if there is not an exact match to your protein, there might very well be a partial match to your protein. Okay? To a protein that's in the database. Okay? So the idea of threading, okay, or inverse protein folding, is to take a look at all the sort of basic simple folds or simple structures that have been observed in proteins. You have the set of crystallized proteins, proteins that have, the structures have been experimentally determined. And then what you try to do is align an input protein that you want to fold against a model given by some existing set of folds. And try to see how well you can score it, okay? How well you can thread that structure along the model, okay? And that is sort of the idea of a threading program. You're given an input, the interesting part, the geometrically interesting part of a protein structure in the database. You're given as input an amino acid sequence. And you want to now ask yourself, is there a way to take your amino acid sequence and thread it through this structure, okay, so that the atoms, so that the appropriate residues in this known structure, okay, should take on the shape, match the basic properties of the amino acid sequence you have, and also sort of retain that basic structure. Okay, that is sort of the threading kind of an idea. I don't know if I said that clearly or not, or yes. Okay, so the Rosetta Stone concept, the way that I would think about it, is you take your database of known folds. I get a little bit something a little bit different, okay? You take it as input your known sequences, your known folds with sequences attached to them, okay? So you have this protein sequence. Bases of amino acid, but you actually have folded this thing.
You know the position of every atom, every amino acid in space from that folding. Here you had a sequence of three amino acids. They folded up into this U-like thing. You will build up a database of all the tiny sub-pieces, okay, of existing folds, saying, hey, when I had an ACN, it folded like this, okay? And when I had a, FTTX, it folded like this. And now you've got several, you took your 2,000 proteins. You cut them up into, let's say they had a total of, each one had a total of 100 residues. You cut them up into 100 times 2,000 pieces. Okay? And for each little piece, you know sort of what it does. Now I give you a input amino acid, an input protein sequence. You see what little substructures you have seen that match these amino acid sequences. Exactly. Okay? And then try to stitch these things together. Okay? So here what you're trying to do is to go from the sequence information. Given that my new protein has little subsequences that match in the old database, okay, I'm going to try to build up little pieces of structure from little things that match. Folding is the sort of threading approach is more like trying to match large scale structures. Okay? Yes. Okay, so what you're saying is this idea of the Rosetta Stone idea, chopping into little pieces, seems dangerous because, in fact, that the shape that this little piece is going to take depends on the global configuration. And you're 100% right, but if you want to do de novo prediction without really assuming a set of known structures, this is a way to sort of hash and punch up the known structures so that you're not relying on them too heavily. What threading is saying is that protein that you have just sequenced, okay, is going to be similar to something in our database, okay, and you have to figure out which one it is, okay, and that's sort of taking a larger scale exploitation. That's trying to take a given input protein sequence and match it with a given 3D structure. That's a little different than cutting it into 3D structures into small pieces and seeing if we can reuse them. That's what I would say is the difference between the two methods. Okay? Any questions? So, threading makes sense if we live in a world where there are only a small number of different proteins in the world. Okay, and then real protein structures in the world. And eventually you're going to see them all. This is sort of the same idea as the homology-based gene recognizers, right? That somehow that you had a new DNA, you had a DNA sequence you just sequenced. How can you identify where the genes are? Well, you can do a homology search to see if there is an existing gene in some other species that's similar to something, then it probably is a gene. This kind of a method would work potentially well to predict structures that are already known, okay, but would probably do badly if the structure, the new protein that you're sequencing has a completely different shape than anything else you've seen, okay? The assumption here is that if there are a finite number of structures, you'll eventually see them all, and eventually, the more and more you learn, the more and more accurate these kind of methods would get, okay? Any questions? The philosophy, I think, should make some sense, okay? It's always a little disappointing to me because you always, somehow it seems like making these predictions from scratch always seems more exciting, okay, than relying on just sort of reusing something, okay? But again, these methods tend to be more accurate, okay? Any questions? Yeah. Well, this is now for 3D prediction. I'm not trying to predict where the atoms are, where the amino acid residues are in space. Secondary structure prediction was just telling me what is a coil and what is a helix.
So that's a simpler problem, okay? This seems to be the better way to solve the more complicated problem, okay? Any questions? Right, so what you might say, for example, here is a, here was our protein structure from before. Let's look at the stop protein. The interesting part of it seemed to be that you have here three sheets, below it three sheets, and you have one helix sitting over here. Now, there was a particular amino acid sequence that gave rise to that. Suppose I give you another amino acid sequence. I don't really care too much about the loops. I want to know, is there a way to take that amino acid sequence, thread it through this, just the interesting parts of the structure, those three flat things below in that helix, such that my amino acid sequence aligned with the parts of the structure that matter match up well. Okay? And so the two parts of this game are, one, determining a cost function for judging how an alignment of the whole amino acid sequence against a partial structure is. And second, how do you find the possible alignments? Okay? Any questions? That's sort of the game that we're trying to play. So what is the threading problem? The threading problem takes as input a protein sequence, takes as input a core model describing the geometric positions of the core residues, okay, meaning the parts of the protein that seem to be stable and that people care about, and the allowable lengths for the loops between different pieces. Finally, it then takes a scoring function, okay, that will, for a given threading, okay, of the protein sequence along the model, will score how good it is, okay? And then the basic algorithm is, try either all threadings or enough threadings, and pick the one that is best, okay? That is the basic idea of threading. Any questions? Okay? So what might you want to include in your cost model? That's sort of seemingly the interesting thing here. Okay? Again, my way of thinking about this is, my core model is probably going to say, here you've got three amino acids in a feed. Here you've got space. Five amino acids in a helix. You know the geometric positions of these things, okay? You know how far away they are. What do you take into account? Well, first of all, in the model that you were looking at, each one of these amino acids in these structures was labeled. There was a protein here, okay, that had these amino acids in those positions. When you thread your sequence along that, you're going to be putting a different set of proteins, of amino acids, in those positions. We've seen before that certain amino acids are similar to other amino acids. Certain ones are not. They have similar properties. So you can imagine getting a certain amount of points for how much does the similar, the amino acid that you're putting in this position in the threading match the one in the database. Okay? Another issue is that there are, it's going to be a loop that's sort of free to wiggle around that's going to connect these pieces together. There will presumably be some constraints as to how long or short a loop it might be for this to match the other one. Okay? Clearly, the length of the loop has to be at least long enough to have enough amino acids to cover the distance between here and there. And probably if the loop is too much longer than the original one, that probably doesn't score as well as an alignment. Okay, so that makes sense as something to do. Finally, there is another term, which is that all these amino acids, once you assign bases to these things are going to interact with each other
in various ways. There's charge issues. Some of these are charged differently than others. Some of these are hydrophobic, some of them are hydrophilic. Maybe you don't want to have these two amino acids don't like to be near each other. So there is another component to the model that for all the four positions in the model, we know geometrically how far apart they are. Certain pairs of a residence might be close enough that they can interact, and if they interact, they may interact positively or negatively. And so you get a point for every pairwise, either you get a point or you lose a point, depending upon the pairwise interaction of these residues. Okay? Does everybody sort of see that? So you can sort of imagine that, again, just to, you know, get myself in trouble, you can maybe imagine that, if we're doing a dinner party credit, okay, it's good to have, you know, male, female sitting next to each other at the dinner table. Okay, and if you wanted to align your group with the dinner party, you had all male amino acids, these things might fight with that. Okay? But you would like to instead have the credit, you know, the pairwise interaction property might be that within this space you want to make sure that each one is different than its neighbor in some way. Okay? So that's what I'll argue the pairwise similarity metrics should be. Yes? Well, the global energy function is, to a certain extent, all that we're really doing in aligning it is aligning the pieces of our core model. So the pairwise interactions really are going to be the computing, if you wish, the global energy interaction of the core part of the model. So that's what we're computing here. We're not going to worry about the energy of the loops. But in some sense, what that pairwise interactions are really getting at, I think, is that level of interaction. Any questions? Okay? So basically, at this point, you now have a dynamic programming problem, where you would have a dynamic program, you almost have a dynamic programming problem. You've got the structures, you know you've got a sequence that's going to align with it. You've got a starting point and an ending point here, a starting point and an ending point here. If you tried all possible subsets of starting and ending points, okay, you could then try, you would evaluate over all of them. You could find the model that gives the alignment that gives the highest score. And what I want to argue with is that if you ignore the pairwise interactions and just consider an alignment where you score the similarity of the bases at each position and the length of the loops, this will be a straightforward dynamic programming kind of an alignment. Okay? Because really now what we're talking about is you've got an input sequence here. You've got a model that consists of pieces. There's going to be a cost function for aligning a base with a piece. There's going to be a cost for doing deletions or too many deletions here. I want to argue that if all you were doing was using the first two things in your spreading function, you could do this fairly easily by dynamic programming. But in fact, allowing these pairwise interactions between bases ends up making it a much more complicated problem. And in fact, you know, when you model full threading in its full generality, computing the optimal solution to these kind of things for sufficiently general cost functions turns out to be an NP-complete problem. Any questions? Okay. Now this seems weird to me when I, I should take it back. It's not, it's a wrong part. This seems kind of weird to me, okay, when I first heard it, okay? Why is it that interacting protein structure, when you allow base interactions, why is it that the problem becomes NP-complete to optimally thread the thing? And there are a bunch of different proofs for special cases. Let me just show you something that I find kind of convincing. Suppose, let's say, my protein sequence was modeled as two different types of amino acids. Let's call them 0-1. And it was 0-1, 0-1, 0-1, 0-1. Okay? Let's now say I want to align it against a model here, where at every position I'm allowed to, if I want, have a loop of side one. So here I've got a sequence of 0, 1 to the end as my protein sequence. And I've got as my model that I'm aligning it for a structure of n core residues. And these n core residues are going to represent the vertices of an underlying graph. Okay, so that's why I'm going to make this an NP-complete kind. I'm doing NP-completeness kind of a reduction here. Okay? By allowing loops of size 0 or of at most 1, I am giving you the freedom to align each one of these positions as being either a 0 or a 1. If I thread this protein along here, I could say go to here without any loop. That would make 0, 1. Let's say I want this to be a 1, I can take my 0 out here and create a loop of size 1. Okay, otherwise I might have a loop of size 0. I claim that by designing a model like this, I can thread it so every one of these core residues is given either a 0 or a 1 in an alignment of this. Everybody sort of believe that?
Yeah. Any questions?
Well, if I now have as my cost function, okay, I now model this graph as being basically a graph that's used in maximum cut, finding the maximum cut, which we discussed as being an NP-complete problem. If my pairwise interaction score gives me a point for every, if I'm taking the 0, 1 assignment as being for every vertex, is it on the left part of the cut or the right part of the cut? Then I claim my alignments, my 2 to the n possible alignments will, my alignments will describe all possible assignments of 0, 1. All possible bipartitions of the vertices. If my interaction score is, I get a penalty of 1 every time the vertices that correspond to an edge in the graph get assigned different scores, then in fact the pairwise penalty I get is going to be exactly the size of the cut. And so if I want to maximize the penalty or make that the reward instead of the penalty, I claim it's sort of like solving a maximum cut problem. That's sort of clear or clear enough? Any questions? So the interesting thing is these threading algorithms, okay, end up in some sense trying to find the best possible alignment between a model and a protein is a hard problem. But in practice, you can use heuristics, you can use, if you're very clever, you might be able to use exhaustive search for small proteins. And bottom line, there are the threading programs that are out there, okay, tend to do fairly well, okay? Any questions? Okay, so in that, we talked last class about the CAS competition, this protein folding competition, which we'll probably hear more about in a little bit. But the CAS people have two different categories, one for judging the de novo programs, one for judging the threading programs. Because on proteins that do match something in the database, the threading programs are much better. But if all you had were threading programs, you'd never discover anything new. Okay, so it's a sort of both sort of important and reasonable approaches. Any questions? Okay, very good. Okay, so now I think I'd like to turn it over to Asim, and we'll go and hopefully learn a little bit more about how these programs are used. Any questions? Okay. Here. You don't mind being recorded for history, do you? Okay, good. Okay.
No, I can't. That's why I have to stick projector a little bit either over there or something.
Do you have enough power cord or not?
I'll find out.
Go back, plug it in the wall, and let's either you zoom or let's flat down there.
My name is Ashu. I am a graduate of the Department of Chemistry, and I'm actually working in a computational biology lab, computer simulation using molecular dynamics, and my actually current project is kind of on de novo structure prediction. So, since we're on this topic, I just wanted to show you a couple of things, what has been done in this area, and also I will, since we mentioned in the class as well, they are not that successful yet. I'm also going to talk about successful methods like spreading approaches and homology modeling, and I'll also show you some results of the recent test competitions and how well did they perform like years ago and how well do they perform right now. Okay, just really to that this slide, this is the relationship which we have also covered in this class, from the DNA sequence, the DNA sequence also plays the protein sequence, but to get the function, we actually have to know the structure. And it is believed that all the information necessary is actually coded in the gene sequence, so given the conditions like temperature and so on, the sequence, the structure the protein takes actually is already in the sequence. And why is it important to get the function or to get the misfunction for like the drug discovery or drug research? Because sometimes proteins don't fold correctly and they want to find out why. If there's a mutation or something else changed, or can it hinder extraction for drug discovery? So it's function as well as misfunction is really important in that area. Okay. As I said, today I will talk about two types of programs or approaches that are working on the protein folding. The first one is simulations, which are trying to do the known structure prediction, just given the sequence, not additional information. And also, I'll talk about the homology modeling approaches, which up to date, they are more successful, and in such cases, there are some cases that actually perform really, really well. So, I'll start with simulations. As I said, I'm working on some with simulations, so what are they trying to do? First thing is, they try to simulate real behavior of proteins. We talked in the class as well, doing a huge confirmation search for a protein, let's say 100 amino acids, and trying to find the best fold is almost impossible. And the nature doesn't do it in that way anyway. So, the idea of simulation is actually confirming any initial starting structure, just try to simulate the real behavior because the proteins follow to the certain pathways and fold to the structure. So if you can actually simulate this behavior, the way it's happening in the nature, you should go to the right answer. So the most important or the biggest advantage of simulation is real-time detail. Since you can model every atom specifically, you can know where every particle goes, how they behave. But since I'm going to come to that in the next slide. The time scales that we can simulate right now is really, really short. So there are two main types, molecular dynamic simulations and Monte Carlo simulations. Next slide, I'll come to their differences as well.
Is the reason why you can only simulate short time scales because of the necessary, the computation is so large, or is it because the physics is not understood well enough?
I want to show the next slide first, because I want to show an example of the energy function and how complicated it is. The first, actually, three terms are not that complicated, because every atom has, or neighboring atoms has bonds, so we have one term for that. We have angles, we have the rotation angles in the amino acids, but the long-range interactions here, these are pairwise interactions, and they have to be calculated for every atom that are further apart than four. And the larger the system gets, actually we have to calculate this, and it's like on the end of the system, the calculations increase by n squared all the time. Plus, usually the amino acids don't just fold in vacuum, they're in cells, so you have to put water molecules in. For one amino acid, you may have to put like 10,000 water molecules in, which for one step of calculation, you technically have to do millions of pairwise interactions. So that's why the time scales that can be covered is short. So both of the simulation methods like molecular dynamics and Monte Carlo, they use similar energy functions from different complementary programs. They sometimes change a couple of terms, but the basic idea is this. And as I said, the long-range interactions, especially all the pairwise interactions, have to be calculated, so that actually makes the calculations really, really long. The differences between Monte Carlo and molecular dynamics? Molecular dynamics actually tries to simulate real behavior. So it calculates the energies, tries to predict where the particles are going to move, makes this move, and calculates the energies again, and calculates the next move. Monte Carlo, however, just puts a random move, looks at the new energies. If it's feasible, it accepts. If not, just accepts it by a random number generated by the probabilities. So both of them have advantages and disadvantages. Like molecular dynamics, for example, it's the real behavior. So if your scoring function is right, the models are most of the time right now, just the biggest problem may be the scoring function still, which my actual work is on the scoring function improvements. You'll see the real behavior. The other one, well, it's easy to get stuck at some point because our four time scales are like nanoseconds up to microseconds. But the proteins, the fastest ones fall in milliseconds. Usually they are a couple of seconds, so they are like 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 of orders of magnitude short still. So it's easy to get stuck. The other one, since it uses probabilities, it can actually, from the local minima, it can jump to another one. So it can actually cover a little bit more space, but it's not the real behavior. Sometimes, instead of going towards the right answer, it may go towards the wrong answer. So both of them has ups and downs. The most commonly used simulation programs, or program packages actually, they are like small programs in program suites like I can name Amber, Charm, Gromos, Tinker. These are most of them are commercial licensed, but academically they're either free or really cheap. I want to show actually up to date the only successful protein structure prediction using a simulation de novo approach. It's a small protein called tryptase, which is only 20 amino acids. Technically, it is nothing. All the proteins in the living organisms are hundreds of amino acids long. But this is the only one, and it was actually done by our group, which was published like a month ago. And this is the only one, and this is just a random structure I show you, and I hope it will work. Actually, you can see how it arranges itself, and a couple more sections. And all of that is arranged. And I just close the section. So actually, we were able to, computers were fast enough, or maybe there's an easier way to calculate the long-range interaction so we can actually spend some time. You would be able to see the whole folding process. It's not just a structure. You can see how it goes there, how fast it goes, or why is it fast, why is it slow, all of the things we can see.
Now, why do you believe this is necessarily the structure and not an artifact of your simulation?
Well, this is just one of the trajectories that I'm showing here. What we did was we selected a lot of random conformations and simulated them, and then looked actually where all of them are going, which pathways they follow. And also, since we cannot, it's also assumed that the thermodynamically, the folded protein has its at lowest global energy, minimum. So we can also calculate the energies. We have the energies anyway. We see whether this structure actually corresponds to the low energy structure. And we run, like, I don't know, 50 separate simulations, and most of them came to this. And then we actually submitted the coordinates to the people who were working on this as experimentally, and they actually said, like, within one axiom or so. So they're actually really good.
What's the color doing?
Oh, it's just the gray color actually represents the backbone, and the other ones, the bulky and important side chains, just to show how they pass. The actual structure, the side chain packing is important and hard to get. It's actually on foreground here, but there's an alpha helix here and there's like a core region. If I didn't have that, maybe it would be easy to see. Yes? This is a molecular dynamics.
What is the
dynamical equation? Well, technically, the way it works is you have the energy. You take the derivative and calculate the forces on each particle. You have the masses. You get the acceleration velocities. It's called the Eigenvalue algorithm. How to calculate the velocities and just predict the next time. And you just have to use really small time steps. So just every femtosecond, which is 10 to the minus 15 seconds, you have to perform all the energy calculations over again. Yes?
How long does that entire process take?
Well, you mean computationally or in real cells?
In real cells.
Well, the fastest ones fall within milliseconds. So the one we can simulate is still up to microseconds, so it's still off.
And also, how long does it take to compute this?
Oh, well, it depends. I think that we have a large cluster in our lab, like 100 CPUs. Using multiple CPUs, you can actually get a reasonable trajectory in 2 or 3 weeks. Well, I personally, when I started the lab, I started simulation and I got the result in 6 months. So 3 weeks is a good, actually reasonable time period. Excuse me? Well, that's what everyone believes, but no. We actually have multiple simulations running, so actually, after you get into a rhythm, when you're waiting for the result or something, you can actually look into results for a finished simulation. So you, there's always something to do. Okay. But, okay, since 20 is a real low number.
I have a silly question. How long would it take to actually do the structure prediction with X-ray crystallography or something like that? 6 months is presumably...
Well, the thing is, the X-ray crystallography is kind of tricky. You may actually get lucky in your first couple of trials. You can get the crystal, but it may take a couple of years or your whole PhD. Mm-hmm. But if I have to get a figure, I actually... the neighboring land is an X-ray crystallography lab, and I just went and talked to them. How long, actually, what's the cost to you to get a reasonable structure or a nice publication? They say $500,000 or so for a decent publication, $1 million or so for a Nature publication. Yes? Oh, it's different. I mean, if you are doing structure prediction, actually, the initial structure doesn't matter that much. The way we use most of the time, we run at a really high temperature one just to get the things to move faster because of the kinetics, but they are unreasonable structures. Just that random one make it. And create an ensemble first, all different, and then just set our parameters to native parameters, and then wait actually get to the lab. But if you read prediction, the initial structure doesn't matter as long as it's not completely unreasonable thing, like chemically not wrong or something. It doesn't matter that much. You get all the structures in between, so you can actually, if you can do this with simulations, you can get all the trajectory, all the movements, all the behavior, which parts of the protein falls first. So you can see, for example, do helices form first, do sheets form first, or how do the moves behave? Yes, you can. But as I say, the time scales are really off right now. Yes?
Now, as you can actually mention, you said that for you to go to the Nature thing.
Yes.
And how long would it take for class playing for this? Because it's not that you have a random structure like in the simulation. You have a random starting point and then it starts floating and comes to it.
Yes.
Probably this order point is happening because it's getting translated.
True.
And
I'm just getting translated for me. Well, to be honest, I don't know how that time scale works, but I can tell you how that millisecond experiment is done. Usually, the proteins have their structure on their native environment, like body temperature, certain concentration, salt concentration, whatever. The way they do it, for example, they heat it up. It just unfolds and it's not functioning anymore. You can measure the functionality. Then we actually put it back in the normal conditions, then they say how actually it comes back. And this is not much different than what we're doing. So it's actually a completely random structure or distorted structure, let me say like this. And how long does it take to come back? And that's what we're doing. We also run the first high temperature, trying to create an ensemble and then fold them all back.
Yes? In this prediction results determine any other measure gathers the results.
Well, right now we're actually working on model development, and this is, as I said, the only one right now, which was, our lab, it was developed in our lab, but this is the only one that is so close to experimental results, and actually we had reported before they published them, so, but it's still the model development stage. We tried our latest energy model to that, and it worked, so we're trying now other proteins. So, or small peptides to validate that, because just one Do you think that we put this all doesn't mean our actually whole function is globally true?
Just another method of the power model.
Yes.
Well,
that has not been tried in the system yet. But if you use the same energy function, it probably will be the same because the energy function is kind of the driving force anyway. So if your function and your model is correct, then Monte Carlo monothermic stages actually produce the moment. So technically, it should go to the same result.
What is the physical dimension? How big?
Well, it is 20 amino acids, but you mean like?
Yeah, how many amino acids are on the
Well, exact numbers I don't know.
No, I mean, so this is basically the potential that you're using is a electrostatic potential. Are there any simulations using quantum mechanics, or that's not necessary?
Well, quantum mechanics, we cannot apply this, like in a simulation technique. Systems that large, now I'm saying this is a large system for quantum mechanics, but most of the parameters in the energy function, they are derived from quantum mechanics. So you first, the way to develop them is you actually match them for quantum mechanics, and then use them on larger systems. And actually, you try them on known systems first to see whether actually they really apply, are they transferable, and then you can actually try predicting something. Well, the other one, and currently the one used knowledge modeling or the trading approach is the one actually we discussed. Like, I'm going to go fast with these. I'm just going to show you how these work and show a couple of my screenshots from the software we used. Knowledge modeling techniques, they give an answer. Not like simulations, they don't give you a whole trajectory of how it works. It just does the matching and gives a set of coordinates saying that these are the coordinates for your amino acids. How it works? I don't know if you read this, but it just has four basic steps. First is a template selection and fold assignment. The second is target template alignment. Target is your actually sequence you want to find the structure. Templates are the ones after the global search you use and to try to fit in. This is important stage, how actually build the coordinates, how to build the models. And there are a couple of little issues. If you can actually have the core elements, like all the sheets and helices, right, then you can actually work on getting the hard part, like loops and side chains as well. And then you have to look whether your model is actually really reasonable. This is actually the way, and here there's also a small illustration. Here the sequence, you don't know, but you find seamless sequences with known folds. You just align them first, then get your target coordinates and look at it whether it's a reasonable model or not. And if not, you just go back, do the fitting again. If that doesn't work, try to find new templates.
For fitting and for checking if it's a reasonable model, you will need a segment
of the model? Well, that's one way, actually. First of all, you check whether does it look reasonable, because there are like a couple of rules, not rules, but when you search the databases of known structures, there are a couple of properties of all proteins that have. You have to look whether your model has that. For example, the angles between amino acids, they are not fixed, but they usually populate in certain regions. First you look at that, whether it's actually in that region, or you have real unreasonable things. Or you look at distances between them. Are they too close, closer than it should, or further away than it should? Things like that, because this is the modeling evaluation part. You can also look at the energetics, of course, but we use that actually for small refinement, and I'm going to talk about it just really briefly how it is done. Oops. Okay. Well, the first thing is actually we have a sequence, and we have to find similar sequences. And we actually, in the class, talked about this as well. We can search the databases using like RAS or FASTA to find similar sequences. The simplest one is using RAS or FASTA just to find one or maybe a couple related or similar sequences. The higher the score, the better. But you can, for example, if you can't find a really good match, like 60, 70, 80%, then you can actually try to find multiple sequences that match your target. So you can actually take parts of one sequence and take other parts of other sequence, try to build yourself a more general model. If that doesn't work, then you can put your actually you can separate smaller segments from all known proteins and try to thread them back to back, and hopefully somehow with the loops and everything try to get the right answer. But the most important criteria is actually your identity. If you can find identical molecules or identical proteins, then it's usually correct. I'm not going to go into how the search is done because we also covered it in the class. After the search is really crude. You just want to see whether they are similar or not. But when you find the similar proteins and you select them, like if you have multiple hits, you can select them whether they come from the same family, they're in similar environments, or do they have better experimental data available. Some of, for example, you may have two structures, but one of them can have a really good crystal structure available. The other one can be from 1980s, really crappy one. So you select a better one, things like that. After you select that, you align them. And there are a couple of observations people make. For example, if you can have an alignment over 40%, the answer you get is most probable that it's going to be correct. Below 40, it's actually, you can find local regions like helices and sheets that you can match them well, but you have large gaps and groups connecting to them which you don't have more information about. And below 30, well, you use spinning approaches or short segments, but it gets tricky, and actually the person who wrote how to do that calls it like watching Twilight Zone on TV. So you never know what's going to happen. Okay, after you have an alignment, and hopefully a good one, you build your model. Building your model is actually assigning coordinates to the amino acids you have about their shape. And there are three major methods that I use. One of them is called rigid body assembly, which technically tries to put the framework and puts the core or the nomons first and tries to assign the groups according to that framework. The second one is called segment matching. It bisects the protein into six amino acid chunks, aligns them first from a database. They create a database themselves, but that method is not that widely used, so I don't know how reliable it is. And then puts them back together. The other one is, which I'll talk a little bit detail, I have a couple of cool pictures about this one, it's called substitution by special strains. The way it does is it actually looks at your templates, how things are, and then tries to use some mathematical functions actually to push the coordinates towards that. So, but the site properties, whichever model you use, the answers you're going to get are similar. So the alignment part, or the search part, actually has a bigger effect than building the coordinates or building the model. So, can I see the pictures?
You want to turn out some lights?
Here I have some screenshots from a model, sorry, called Swiss model, which is a web server. You can actually go put your coordinates in there, and I don't know how long it takes, but you can get it's an automated procedure. It asks you a couple of questions during the process, how you want to proceed, but you can get an answer within, I don't know how long. I can try it actually, I don't know. It also depends on the load of the server. But this is actually used the first model, like rigid bodies. Here it has multiple templates, and it just constructs a framework. Here, for example, you can see a sheet here, things like that. And then puts, different methods are possible, like averaging the atoms for assigning your own coordinates or other things, looking at the context, and just puts target amino acids on that framework, the way it fits.
So what about, is it, so each one of the different colors here
different protein, actually.
I see. So you're saying that here was a case where you had like three or four different templates,
yes,
each of which was a protein that was pretty similar to each other.
And so you actually, the thick yellow one is actually your target, and you just put the ones, or the actually good alignment ones, or the good, or similar ones, you just put your coordinates on it, on that framework. And then there are, of course, good regions, other things that you may actually have some additional database structures. They have actual databases for groups now, with you can maybe find a matching segment and just put it in. Or you can also run short simulations. As I said, simulations cannot predict it well. But if you have like a framework, which you know where this part is, just a part you don't know, you can actually assign the groups. Groups are hard to find, but they are important because most of the interesting stuff actually happens on the loops. All the reactions, binding enzymes, and because they can actually flexible, they can adapt without changing the protein that much to the environment. So actually, that's why the models are getting good in getting core segments now, so they're actually putting more effort on getting the loop side as well.
And so this is actually easier to get the core region,
yes,
right?
Because they are, you don't have that many mutations over there, they are conserved.
But that could be the interesting part of saying
yes, the loops, because these are actually very interactive enzymes, for example, interact with their targets, how they bind, how they identify them, and the actual mutations happen sometimes because of that. Some mutations make interactions really easy, so actually that protein works, some of them don't, and those proteins actually don't function, and those organisms may actually die in if it's a really vital process. Question? Okay, this is actually I got from the manual of the program called Modlet, which is a really common use program, and the academic version, you can just go and download. It has SGI, Linux, Windows versions available, so you can actually use whichever you want. The way it does it, it just does the alignment as you would do with the known algorithms. And then, instead of building a framework, it just, from the templates, tries to get properties out. Like, for example, here, what is the distance between these two elements, C and N, and P and, another P, yeah, or K and B. It just tries to get, like, distances, angles from the targets. Then, it's, the important thing is you can actually get these types of restraints from models, but also if you have some experimental data available, not source and structure yet. But you can also derive some restraints out of those and add them. So it's actually powerful to incorporate some experimental data on it, if you have it.
Experimental data, you mean the NMR data?
NMR data, but not like composite enough to construct the structure, but may have actually built the model. And it then uses like geometry optimization or real space optimization algorithms to actually satisfy the restraints or just minimize the violations of those restraints. And here they show actually they just put their sequence completely linear. They start their algorithm, and here's their function they want to minimize. It just arranges itself after multiple iterations, and after 7,000 or so, it comes to a minimum, and they report their results. And even though the models are usually similar to each other, from the source or from the articles I read about this stuff, they actually make this type of the last approach, since you can incorporate some experimental data as well, the most powerful one right now. Also, the articles were written by the producers of the program, maybe. They just want to publicize their own program. I don't know. Okay, other common problems. I'm going to go from the least important one to the more important one. Like, errors in side chains.
What exactly is a side chain?
Okay, all of the amino acids, their backbone structure are same. The only difference they have is actually they have different types of groups attached to those backbone. And with those side chains, so the main chain is always the same. Side chains actually differ, and that's why we give amino acids different names. So almost 80% of all amino acids actually have the same atoms. So this is, I mean, people actually cannot get that right, but they don't care about it that much, because if you get most of the coordinates right, all the main chains are right, maybe loops right, then they're happy. But that's the next step, actually, getting rid of also trying to find a way how to calculate the side chains. They want to get the perfect model. Second one is you can, for example, have good alignments and get structure right, for example, here, but if you can't have the ends right, it may shift. So it may actually show like a big error, even though it's not. for the soil. Actually, it's the same structure, but there are small shifts because of the corner shifts. So they're also trying to get rid of these. The thing is, like books, because books you don't access because of heavy mutations, you don't get patents out of them. So actually, you may predict this, but the loop could be this. So you can never know that. But there actually there have been some advancements in this area right now, and they're moving towards this to reduce the errors. The biggest two errors we have is the misalignments. If you have an alignment problem, you may completely predict something else, or if you select wrong templates, you may get the template right, but it's the wrong answer. It's like having a wrong scoring function. You can actually minimize your function, but it's the wrong answer, so it doesn't matter.
But would you be able to tell that you had the wrong template because the score that you got in aligning it was very bad? Maybe the best possible alignment, but it's still pretty bad.
Well, the thing is, for example, you have a sequence and you know from which organism it comes. Technically, you should know. There are some representative structures out of these types of organisms or these types of enzymes. It's an enzyme. So you kind of know what type of fold it could be or what type of parameters it could have. So you can then selecting your template, you can actually take these into consideration. For example, if you have an enzyme from a mouse, you shouldn't actually try to align it with fruit fly. I mean, it may happen, but if you have it better represented from a mouse or another mammal, it may actually work better. Things like that. Also, the model evaluation stage, sometimes you can also see. The first thing is actually it's reasonable for these structures. As I said, there are some known properties, you check them. And otherwise, does this protein actually make sense? Or does it look like if it's an enzyme, it can do the job? Because you kind of know how them react. So if it doesn't look like it can actually perform the duty, then you may have a wrong template. Also, when you submit the test and it comes out wrong, then you also know. So here are the programs that do the modeling. Common ones, that's Composer, but it's actually not, I think it's not academic available, but it's a part of the commercial program package called Cybo. This modeler I showed, it's academically available, but it's also commercial version is inside program package. The one I like is actually SwissMod. It's a server, it's free, you can actually use it. You can just, as I said, dump report the amino acid sequence and in a short time and some parameters, you can get a result. And there are also other things which all web pages are here, so you can actually go and check them.
What does PNS mean? The second field.
Oh, sorry, I forgot. P means program, S means server. So actually, the ones with S, you can actually log in like a blast search. You don't have to have a database and a program on your computer. But also, since many people use them, sometimes it's useful. So, just a couple of more slides. How well do they perform? So, as I said, the most important parameter is the identity. As you can see, the higher you go with the identity, your models get better and better, and you can even predict almost all the positions of your atoms, even the side chains, even the hydrogen atoms, which you don't actually see the coordinates if you check the PDB, things like that. So you can actually get that fairly accurate. If the sequence identity is around 40, 45, you can still get the main chain back, but you may have problems with loops, but still you have the core region of the molecule quite right. So if it drops below 30, then you have problems. You can still make some deductions, but having a really, you can't be sure of your answer that much. You can say, this protein may have this type of fold, but still, 30% or the sequence identity may not be the right answer. And how are people using these? Let me start from the low identity ones that we cannot trust. You can still use the supplementary data for experiments. You can search for motifs, or you can, as I said, probably guess what type of fold, what type of motifs in the protein are. But as I said, below 30, they don't trust their results yet. between 30 and 60. Actually, you can use it for protein engineering, like some mutagenesis experiments, or it can have like molecular replacement crystallography, which I don't know what it means, but it can help. But you have most of the main chain atoms, right? So you can have actually see how the protein, except maybe the loops, behaves and interacts. But if you get higher than 60, you usually get the right answer. So you can actually have fine specificity. It's comparable to recent NMR experiments or NMR structures. So you can use like for dopings, for small ligands. That means actually you can use them for drug discoveries. You can search actually whether your drug targets or candidates that can bind to your protein, that they can fit, things like that. So it's actually, if you can find high sequence identity, it's good. And more conclusion. So what Christina mentioned also about the test. The test is a kind of competition that happens every 2 years, where they publish the sequences of some structures which are to be solved in the near future, and they say, okay, you have till end of 2000, let's say, time to take these sequences, run your calculations, and sum it as your predicted coordinates. Up to now, four tests have been finished, but there is another one that I think the deadline is at the end of 2002. Test 5, so I don't know how that will turn out. And here I have, and every after every test, they actually issue one special issue in the journal for proteins about their results, how people did, like summaries. And here is actually one graph from those summaries, how did these models work. Here, on the y-axis, we have the sequence identity. So as predicted, the higher the sequence identity goes, the predictions are really good, as you can see here. But there are some reasons actually, that some results around here with lower than 20% identity, which really got good results. So actually people are really working hard on their models, how to implement them. I have a better graph actually.
What is good results?
Actually, this is the sequence identity from your search. And actually, the fractional target factor is superimposed. That means actually that your target matches the actual experiment. So actually, if you're around here, that means it's actually a good model, or your prediction is really good. So actually, these are trivial. I mean, if you have high sequence identity, you're like that. As you can see, the test targets, they usually select the ones with low identity, so they actually really want to give you a challenge. How to do that. But
are these really getting better with time?
I'm going to show the next one. Actually, it shows a little better. If you can see it. So this is actually the all the test targets in all four competitions shown from easier to identify the harder to identify. So, and length of the bar is actually how, actually, length of the bar means the sequence identity. And the shaded area, you can see, is actually the difference between the identity result and the prediction result. So actually, if you have a full bar here, that means you actually predicted the structure correct. But if you have a shaded area, that means you didn't actually did a good job. And also we have color code, like yellow means the first test experiment, which I think should be in 1994. It should be 1994, and the blue one is in 2000. So as you can see, when actual things get harder and harder, the yellow ones, they don't perform that well, but we can see from the purple ones and the blue ones, they actually are getting good hits with the tough ones as time advances. So actually the models are getting better, they can get the loops better now, and they can actually implement some simulation methods after they do the predictions using the energy functions to see whether actually they can improve the structures a little bit. Yes?
How much effort is spent on test?
Well, some research groups that actually work on their models to compete in tests only. But how much effort do they spend only on this, I don't know. I just read a couple of reviews on cast things, cast competition, but exactly how much I don't know. Okay, and I will finish with conclusions. I mentioned in the first part of the talk the computer simulations and how their good parts and bad parts, like they can actually show every detailed motion, how things work and how long things don't work, and but they cannot cover time long enough yet to simulate the large systems. So, and the homology modeling approaches, we saw that if the sequence similarity is high, they perform really well. But also with the implementation of better techniques, with better models, better search algorithms, the training approaches, they actually reduce the error in their assignment, alignment, and the modeling things, and we saw it on the test results, actually, they're getting better. And this is a claim, theoretically, if at least one member of every process was in quality known and was in the database, it should be impossible to predict the structure of every coding sequence within a certain accuracy. Because it is believed that there are a couple of thousand, maybe 5,000 distinct protein folds, but there are more than 500,000 sequences actually in the databases right now, and more coming from sequencing experiments. So they don't have same or similar folds, one way or another. So if actually you had representative of every fold, then it should be possible to model them. Yes? Well, the latest article I read was an article in 2002, and they say they know about 1,000 right now. Excuse me? It's an estimate. So, but for this type of modeling, you may have a sequence with complete unknown code, and it would never, never work. And there are also cases where there are some proteins fall completely the same 3D structure with no sequence identity at all. So, things happen. Oh! Maybe your students will have to worry about that, not you. The crystallography and NMR experiments. And I was actually in a computational chemistry and computational biology seminar a couple of months ago, and they said from 1980s to 2002, what is the advancement in this? So the experimentalists, they looked at the results and said, heck no. Now they're saying no. So currently, no one actually there are some pharmaceutical companies that use these models, but when you go and say, I did homology modeling, I predicted the structure, it is not experimentally available, you submit the PGD, they will put it in.
When, for example, I mean, someone who's doing the crystallographers use these programs to help get guesses to sort of figure out
what might be. Yes, they do. There are different approaches for that, actually. They're implementing more computational techniques, not just this one, to their actually crystal structure refinement experiments, especially. After they have the data, they have to fit the coordinates of the MNS in their data sets. And they actually are starting more computational approaches, like modeling approaches to their system right now. Well, the thing is, the cast targets are too big for simulation. So, I don't know whether we will think of that or not. No, but these methods are the ones that are applicable right now because they are too big to simulate. And with every added MNAS, we actually add lots of conformational freedom, and we have to search more and more and more. So, and also the computational expense increases, but also the conformational freedom and accessible conformations increase. So it's not that easy yet. But there are like a couple of different mathematical tools to implement. For example, instead of solvent, you can approximate it with mathematical equations to just reduce the size of the system, things like that. Or not calculate the long-range interactions every step, but every 5 steps, so they probably don't change that much. Things like that. So think you can speed up the process, but still it's not there yet. Well, you can try, but you probably won't get the right answer because of time issues. Even though your model is correct, because of time limitations, you probably won't get the right answer. But the computers are increasing, the models are getting better, so who knows?
Thank you very much. Thank you. 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 Thank you.